Somewhere in France, Richard Harding Davis. Marie Gessler, known as Marie Chaumontel, Jeanne d'Avrechy, and Countess d'Aurillac, was German. Her father, who served through the Franco-Prussian War, was a German spy. It was from her mother she learned to speak French sufficiently well to satisfy even an academician, and among Parisians, to pass as one. Both her parents were dead. Before they departed, knowing they could leave their daughter nothing save their debts, they had had her trained as a nurse. But when they were gone, Marie, in the Berlin hospitals, played politics, intrigued, and indiscriminately misused the appealing violet eyes. There was a scandal. Several scandals. At the age of 25, she was dismissed from the municipal hospital, and as now, save for the violet eyes, she was without resources. As a compagnon du voyage with a German doctor, she traveled to Monte Carlo. There she abandoned the doctor for Henri Ravignac, a captain in the French Aviation Corps who, when his leave ended, escorted her to Paris. The duties of Captain Ravignac kept him in barracks near the aviation field, but Marie he established in his apartments on the Boulevard Haussmann. One day he brought from the barracks a roll of blueprints, and as he was locking them in a drawer, said,
"The Germans would pay through the nose for those."
The remark was indiscreet, but then Marie had told him she was French, and anyone would have believed her. The next morning, the same spirit of adventure that had exiled her from the Berlin hospitals carried her with the blueprints to the German embassy. There, greatly shocked, they first wrote down her name and address and then, indignant at her proposition, ordered her out. But the day following, a strange young German who was not at all indignant, but on the contrary quite charming, called upon Marie. For the blueprints he offered her a very large sum, and that same hour with them and Marie departed for Berlin. Marie did not need the money, nor did the argument that she was serving her country greatly impress her. It was rather that she loved intrigue, and so she became a spy. Henri Ravignac, the man she had robbed of the blueprints, was tried by court-martial. The charge was treason, but Charles Ravignac, his younger brother, promised to prove that the guilty one was the girl, and to that end obtained leave of absence and spent much time and money. At the trial, he was able to show the record of Marie in Berlin and Monte Carlo, that she was the daughter of a German secret agent, that on the afternoon the prints disappeared, Marie, with an agent of the German embassy, had left Paris for Berlin. In consequence of this, the charge of selling military secrets was altered to one of gross neglect, and Henri Ravignac was sentenced to 2 years in the military prison at Tours. But he was of an ancient and noble family, and when they came to take him from his cell in the Cherche Midi, he was dead. Charles, his brother, disappeared. It was said he also had killed himself, that he had been appointed a military attaché in South America, that to revenge his brother he had entered the Secret Service, but whatever became of him, no one knew. All that was certain was that, thanks to the act of Marie Gessler, on the rolls of the French army the ancient and noble name of Ravignac no longer appeared. In her chosen profession, Marie Gessler found nothing discreditable. Of herself, her opinion was not high, and her opinion of men was lower. For her smiles, she had watched several sacrifice honor, duty, loyalty, and she held them and their kind in contempt. To lie, to cajole, to rob men of secrets they thought important, and of secrets the importance of which they did not even guess, was to her merely an intricate and exciting game. She played it very well. So well that in the service her advance was rapid. On important missions she was sent to Russia, through the Balkans, even to the United States. There, with credentials as an army nurse, she inspected our military hospitals and unobtrusively asked many innocent questions. When she begged to be allowed to work in her beloved Paris, they told her when war came they intended to plant her inside that city, and that until then, the less Paris knew of her, the better. but just before the Great War broke, to report on which way Italy might jump, she was sent to Rome, and it was not until September she was recalled. The telegram informed her that her Aunt Elizabeth was ill and that at once she must return to Berlin. This, she learned from the code book wrapped under the cover of her thermos bottle, meant that she was to report to the general commanding the German forces at Soissons. From Italy, she passed through Switzerland and, after leaving Basel, on military trains was rushed north to Luxembourg and then west to Laon. She was accompanied by her companion Bertha, an elderly and respectable, even distinguished-looking female. In the Secret Service, her number was 528. Their passes from the War Office described them as nurses of the German Red Cross. Only the Intelligence Department knew their real mission. With her also, as her chauffeur, was a young Italian soldier of fortune, Paul Anfossi. He had served in the Belgian Congo, in the French Foreign Legion in Algiers, and spoke all the European languages. In Rome, where as a wireless operator he was serving a commercial company in selling Marie copies of messages he had memorized, Marie had found him useful, and when war came she obtained for him, from the Wilhelmstrasse, the number 292. From Laon, in one of the automobiles of the general staff, the three spies were driven first to Soissons, and then along the road to Meaux and Paris, to the village of Neuchâtel. They arrived at midnight, and in a chateau of one of the Champagne princes, found the colonel commanding the intelligence bureau. He accepted their credentials, destroyed them, and replaced them with a laissez-passer signed by the mayor of Laon. That dignitary, the colonel explained, to citizens of Laon fleeing to Paris and the coast, had issued many passes. But as now between Laon and Paris there were three German armies, the refugees had been turned back and their passes confiscated.
"From among them," said the officer, "we have selected one for you. It is issued to the wife of Count d'Aurillac, a captain of reserves, and her aunt, Madame Benet. It asks for those ladies and their chauffeur, Briand, a safe conduct through the French military lines. If it gets you into Paris, you will destroy it and assume another name. The Count d'Aurillac is now with his regiment in that city. If he learned of the presence there of his wife, he would seek her, and that would not be good for you. So if you reach Paris, you will become a Belgian refugee. You are high-born and rich. Your chateau has been destroyed, but you have money. You will give liberally to the Red Cross. You will volunteer to nurse in the hospitals. With your sad story of ill-treatment by us, with your high birth and your knowledge of nursing, which you acquired, of course, only as an amateur, you should not find it difficult to join the ladies of France or the American ambulance. What you learn from the wounded English and French officers and the French doctors you will send to us through the usual channels."
"When do I start?" asked the woman.
"For a few days," explained the officer, "you remain in this chateau. You will keep us informed of what is going forward after we withdraw."
"Withdraw?"
It was more of an exclamation than a question. Marie was too well trained to ask questions.
"We are taking up a new position," said the officer. "On the Aisne."
The woman, incredulous, stared.
"And we do not enter Paris?"
"You do," returned the officer. "That is all that concerns you. We will join you later, in the spring. Meanwhile, for the winter, we entrench ourselves along the Aisne. In a chimney of this chateau we have set up a wireless outfit. We are leaving it intact. The chauffeur Briand, who you must explain to the French you brought with you from Laon, and who has been long in your service, will transmit whatever you discover. We wish especially to know of any movement towards our left. If they attack in front from Soissons, we are prepared. But of any attempt to cross the Oise and take us in flank, you must warn us."
The officer rose and hung upon himself his field glasses, map cases, and sidearms.
"We leave you now," he said. When the French arrive, you will tell them your reason for halting at the chateau was that the owner, Monsieur Ivanet, and his family are friends of your husband. You found us here, and we detained you. And so long as you can use the wireless, make excuses to remain. If they offer to send you on to Paris, tell them your aunt is too ill to travel. But they will find the wireless, said the woman. They are sure to use the towers for observation, and they will find it.
In that case, said the officer, you will suggest to them that we fled in such haste we had no time to dismantle it. Of course you had no knowledge that it existed, or as a loyal French woman you would have at once told them.
To emphasize his next words, the officer pointed at her.
Under no circumstances, he continued, must you be suspected. If they should take Briand in the act, should they have even the least doubt concerning him, you must repudiate him entirely. If necessary, to keep your own skirts clear, it would be your duty yourself to denounce him as a spy.
Your first orders, said the woman, were to tell them Briand had been long in my service, that I brought him from my home in Laon.
He might be in your service for years, returned the colonel, and you not know he was a German agent.
If to save myself I inform upon him, said Marie, of course you know you will lose him.
The officer shrugged his shoulders.
A wireless operator,
he retorted,
we can replace. But for you and for the service you are to render in Paris, we have no substitute. You must not be found out. You are invaluable.
The spy inclined her head.
Thank you,
she said. The officer sputtered indignantly.
It is not a compliment, he exclaimed. It is an order. You must not be found out.
Withdrawn some 200 yards from the Paris road, the chateau stood upon a wooded hill. Except directly in front, trees of great height surrounded it. The tips of their branches brushed the windows. Interlacing, they continued until they overhung the wall of the estate. Where it ran with the road, the wall gave way to a lofty gate and iron fence, through which those passing could see a stretch of noble turf as wide as a polo field, borders of flowers disappearing under the shadows of the trees, and the chateau itself, with its terrace, its many windows, its high-pitched, sloping roof, broken by towers and turrets. Through the remainder of the night, there came from the road to those in the chateau the roar and rumbling of the army in retreat. It moved without panic, disorder, or haste, but unceasingly. Not for an instant was there a breathing spell. And when the sun rose, the three spies, the two women and the chauffeur, who in the great chateau were now alone, could see as well as hear the gray column of steel rolling past below them. The spies knew that the gray column had reached Clay, had stood within 15 miles of Paris, and then upon Paris had turned its back. They knew also that the reverberations from the direction of Meaux, that each moment grew more loud and savage, were the French 75s, whipping the gray column forward. Of what they felt, the Germans did not speak. In silence they looked at each other, and in the eyes of Marie was bitterness and resolve. Toward noon, Marie met Anne Fossey in the great drawing room that stretched the length of the terrace, and from the windows of which, through the park gates, they could see the Paris road.
This that is passing now, said Marie, is the last of our rear guard. Go to your tower,
she ordered,
and send word that except for stragglers and the wounded, our column has just passed through Neufchelles, and that any moment we expect the French.
She raised her hand impressively.
From now,
she warned,
we speak French, we think French, we are French.
Anne Fossey, or Briand, as now he called himself, addressed her in that language. His tone was bitter.
Pardon, my les majestés, he said, but this chief of your intelligence department is a dummermensch.
He is throwing away a valuable life. Marie exclaimed in dismay. She placed her hand upon his arm and the violet eyes filled with concern.
Not yours,
she protested.
Absolutely, returned the Italian. I can send nothing by this knapsack wireless that they will not learn from others, from airmen, Uhlans, the peasants in the fields. And certainly I will be caught. Dead I am dead, but alive and in Paris the opportunities are unending. From the French Legion Etrangere I have my honorable discharge. I am an expert wireless operator, and in their signal corps I can easily find a place. Imagine me, then, on the Eiffel Tower. From the air I snatch news from all of France, from the Channel, the North Sea. You and I could work together, as in Rome. But here, between the lines, with a pass from a village sous-préfet, it is ridiculous. I am not afraid to die, but to die because someone else is stupid. That is hard.
Marie clasped his hands in both of hers.
You must not speak of death, she cried. You know I must carry out my orders, that I must force you to take this risk. And you know that sort of harm to you tortures me.
Quickly the young man disengaged his hand. The woman exclaimed with anger.
Why do you doubt me?
She cried. Briand protested vehemently.
I do not doubt you.
My affection, then?
In a whisper that carried with it the feeling of a caress, Marie added softly.
My love?
The young man protested miserably.
You make it very hard, mademoiselle, he cried. You are my superior officer. I am your servant. Who am I that I should share with others?
The woman interrupted eagerly.
Ah, you are jealous,
she cried.
Is that why you are so cruel? But when I tell you I love you, and only you, can you not feel it is the truth?
The young man frowned unhappily.
My duty, mademoiselle,
he stammered. With an exclamation of anger, Marie left him. As the door slammed behind her, the young man drew a deep breath. On his face was the expression of ineffable relief. In the hall, Marie met her elderly companion, Bertha, now her aunt, Madame Benet.
I heard you quarreling,
Bertha protested.
It is most indiscreet. It is not in the part of the Countess d'Aurillac that she makes love to her chauffeur.
Marie laughed noiselessly and drew her further down the hall.
He is imbecile,
she exclaimed.
He will kill me with his solemn face and his conceit. I make love to him, yes, that he may work the more willingly. But he will have none of it. He is jealous of the others.
Madame Benet frowned.
He resents the others, she corrected. I do not blame him. He is a gentleman.
And the others?
Demanded Marie.
Were they not of the most noble families of Rome?
I am old and I am ugly,
said Bertha.
But to me, Anfossi is always as considerate as he is to you who are so beautiful.
An Italian gentleman,
returned Marie,
does not serve in Belgian Congo unless it is the choice of that or the marble quarries.
I do not know what his past may be,
sighed Madame Benet.
Nor do I ask. He is only a number, as you and I are only numbers. And I beg you to let us work in harmony. At such a time your love affairs threaten our safety. You must wait.
Marie laughed insolently.
With the Dewberry,
she protested,
I can boast that I wait for no man.
No,
replied the older woman.
You pursue him.
Marie would have answered sharply, but on the instant her interest was diverted. For 1 week, by day and night, she had lived in a world peopled only by German soldiers. Beside her in the railroad carriage, on the station platforms, at the windows of the trains that passed the one in which she rode, at the grade crossings, on the bridges, in the roads that paralleled the tracks, choking the streets of the villages and spread over the fields of grain, she had seen only the gray-green uniforms. Even her professional eye no longer distinguished regiment from regiment, dragoon from grenadier, Uhlan from hussar or landsturm. Stripes, insignia, numerals, badges of rank had lost their meaning. Those who wore them no longer were individuals. They were not even human. During the 3 last days, the automobile, like a motorboat fighting the tide, had crept through a gray-green river of men, stained, as though from the banks, by mud and yellow clay. And for hours, while the car was blocked, and in fury the engine raced and purred, the gray-green river had rolled past her, slowly but as inevitably as lava down the slope of a volcano, bearing on its surface faces with staring eyes, thousands and thousands of eyes, some fierce and bloodshot, others filled with weariness, homesickness, pain. At night she still saw them. The white faces under the sweat and dust, the eyes dumb, inarticulate, asking the answer. She had been suffocated by German soldiers, by the mass of them, engulfed and smothered. She had stifled in a land inhabited only by gray-green ghosts. And suddenly, as though a miracle had been wrought, she saw upon the lawn riding toward her a man in scarlet, blue, and silver. One man riding alone. Approaching with confidence but alert, his reins fallen, his hands nursing his carbine, his eyes searching the shadows of the trees, the empty windows, even the sun-swept sky. His was the new face at the door, the new step on the floor, and the spy knew had she beheld an army corps it would have been no more significant, no more menacing, than the solitary chasseur à cheval scouting in advance of the enemy.
"We are saved,"
exclaimed Marie with irony.
"Go, quickly,"
she commanded,
"to the bedroom on the second floor that opens upon the staircase, so that you can see all who pass. You are too ill to travel. They must find you in bed."
"And you?" said Bertha.
"I,"
cried Marie rapturously,
"hasten to welcome our preserver."
The preserver was a peasant lad. Under the white dust his cheeks were burned a brown red, his eyes honest and blue, through much staring at the skies and at horizon lines, were puckered and encircled with tiny wrinkles. Responsibility had made him older than his years, and in speech brief. With the beautiful lady who with tears of joy ran to greet him, and who in an ecstasy of happiness pressed her cheek against the nose of his horse, he was unimpressed. He returned to her her papers, and gravely echoed her answers to his questions.
"This chateau," he repeated, "was occupied by the general staff. They have left no wounded here. You saw the last of them pass a half hour since."
He gathered up his reins. Marie shrieked in alarm.
"You will not leave us?"
she cried. For the first time the young man permitted himself to smile.
"Others arrive soon," he said.
He touched his shako, wheeled his horse in the direction from which he had come, and a minute later Marie heard the hoofs echoing through the empty village. When they came, the others were more sympathetic. Even in times of war, a beautiful woman is still a beautiful woman, and the staff officers who moved into the quarters so lately occupied by the enemy found in the presence of the Countess d'Aurillac nothing to distress them. In the absence of her dear friend, Madame Ivernay, the châtelaine of the chateau, she acted as their hostess. Her chauffeur showed the company cooks the way to the kitchen, the larder, and the charcoal box. She herself, in the hands of General André, placed the keys of the famous wine cellar and, to the surgeon, that the wounded might be freshly bandaged, entrusted those of the linen closet. After the indignities she had suffered while detained by Les Boches, her delight and relief at again finding herself under the protection of her own people would have touched a heart of stone. And the hearts of the staff were not of stone. It was with regret they gave the Countess permission to continue on her way. At this she exclaimed with gratitude. She assured them, were her aunt able to travel, she would immediately depart.
"In Paris she will be more comfortable than here," said the kind surgeon. He was a reservist, and in times of peace a fashionable physician, and as much at his ease in a boudoir as in a field hospital. "Perhaps if I saw Madame Benet?"
At the suggestion, the Countess was overjoyed. But they found Madame Benet in a state of complete collapse. The conduct of the Germans had brought about a nervous breakdown.
"So the bridges are destroyed at Meaux," urged the surgeon. "Even with a detour, you can be in Paris in 4 hours. I think it is worth the efforts."
But the mere thought of the journey threw Madame Benet into hysterics. She asked only to rest. She begged for an opiate to make her sleep. She begged also that they would leave the door open, so that when she dreamed she was still in the hands of the Germans, and woke in terror, the sound of the dear French voices and the sight of the beloved French uniforms might reassure her. She played her part well. Concerning her, Marie felt not the least anxiety. But toward Briand, the chauffeur, the new arrivals were less easily satisfied. The general sent his adjutant for the Countess. When the adjutant had closed the door, General André began abruptly.
"The chauffeur Briand," he asked. "You know him? You can vouch for him?"
"But certainly," protested Marie. "He is an Italian."
As though with sudden enlightenment, Marie laughed. It was as if now, in the suspicion of the officer, she saw a certain reasonableness.
"Briand was so long in the Foreign Legion in Algiers," she explained, "where my husband found him, that we have come to think of him as French. As much French as ourselves, I assure you."
The general and his adjutant were regarding each other questioningly.
"Perhaps I should tell the Countess," began the general, "that we have learned."
The signal from the adjutant was so slight, so swift, that Marie barely intercepted it. The lips of the general shut together like the leaves of a book. To show the interview was at an end, he reached for a pen.
"I thank you," he said.
"Of course," prompted the adjutant, "Madame de Aurillac understands the man must not know we inquired concerning him."
General André frowned at Marie.
"Certainly not," he commanded. "The honest fellow must not know that even for a moment he was doubted."
Marie raised the violet eyes reprovingly.
"I trust," she said with reproach, "I too well understand the feelings of a French soldier to let him know his loyalty is questioned."
With a murmur of appreciation, the officers bowed, and with a gesture of gracious pardon, Marie left them. Outside in the hall, with none but orderlies to observe, like a cloak the graciousness fell from her. She was drawn in two ways. In her work, Anfossi was valuable, but Anfossi suspected was less than of no value. He became a menace, a death warrant. General André had said, "We have learned," and the adjutant had halted him. What had he learned? To know that, Marie would have given much. Still, one important fact comforted her. Anfossi alone was suspected. Had there been concerning herself the slightest doubt, they certainly would not have allowed her to guess her companion was under surveillance. They would not have asked one who was herself suspected to vouch for the innocence of a fellow conspirator. Marie found the course to follow difficult. With Anfossi under suspicion, his usefulness was for the moment at an end, and to accept the chance offered her to continue on to Paris seemed most wise. On the other hand, if, concerning Anfossi, she had succeeded in allaying their doubts, the results most to be desired could be attained only by remaining where they were. Their position inside the lines was of the greatest strategic value. The rooms of the servants were under the roof, and that Briand should sleep in one of them was natural. That to reach or leave his room he should constantly be ascending or descending the stairs also was natural. The field wireless outfit, or as he had disdainfully described it, the knapsack wireless, was situated not in the bedroom he had selected for himself, but in one adjoining. At other times this was occupied by the maid of Madame Ivernay. To summon her maid, Madame Ivernay, from her apartment on the second floor, had but to press a button. And it was in the apartment of Madame Ivernay, and on the bed of that lady, that Madame Benet now reclined. When, through the open door, she saw an officer or soldier mount the stairs, she pressed the button that rang a bell in the room of the maid. In this way, long before whoever was ascending the stairs could reach the top floor, warning of his approach came to Anfossi. It gave him time to replace the dust board over the fireplace in which the wireless was concealed and to escape into his own bedroom. The arrangement was ideal, and already information picked up in the halls below by Marie had been conveyed to Anfossi to relay in a French cipher to the German general staff at Reims. Marie made an alert and charming hostess. To all who saw her, it was evident that her mind was intent only upon the comfort of her guests. Throughout the day, many came and went, but each she made welcome. To each, as he departed, she called bonne chance. Efficient, tireless, tactful, she was everywhere. In the dining room, in the kitchen, in the bedrooms, for the wounded finding mattresses to spread in the gorgeous salons of the Champagne Prince, for the soldier chauffeurs carrying wine into the courtyard, where the automobiles panted and growled and the arriving and departing shrieked for right of way. At all times an alluring person, now the one woman in a tumult of men, her smart frock covered by an apron, her head and arms bare, undismayed by the sight of the wounded or by the distant rumble of the guns. The Countess d'Aurillac was an inspiring and beautiful picture. The eyes of the officers, young and old, informed her of that fact, one of which already she was well aware. By the morning of the next day she was accepted as the owner of the chateau, and though continually she reminded the staff she was present only as the friend of her schoolmate, Madame Ivernay, they deferred to her as to a hostess. Many of them she already saluted by name, and to those who with messages were constantly monitoring to and from the front at Soissons, she was particularly kind. Overnight, the legend of her charm, of her devotion to the soldiers of all ranks, had spread from Soissons to Meaux, and from Meaux to Paris. It was noon of that day when from the window of the second story Marie saw an armored automobile sweep into the courtyard. It was driven by an officer, young and appallingly good-looking, and, as was obvious by the way he spun his car, one who held in contempt both the law of gravity and death. That he was someone of importance seemed evident. Before he could alight, the adjutant had raced to meet him. With her eye for detail, Marie observed that the young officer, instead of imparting information, received it. He must, she guessed, have just arrived from Paris, and his brother officer either was telling him the news or giving him his orders. Whichever it might be, in what was told him, the new arrival was greatly interested. One instant, in indignation, his gauntleted fist beat upon the steering wheel, the next he smiled with pleasure. To interpret this pantomime was difficult, and the better to inform herself, Marie descended the stairs. As she reached the lower hall, the two officers entered. To the spy, the man last to arrive was always the one of greatest importance, and Marie assured herself that through her friend, the adjutant, to meet with this one would prove easy. But the chauffeur commander of the armored car made it most difficult. At sight of Marie, much to her alarm, as though greeting a dear friend, he snatched his kept from his head and sprang toward her.
"The major," he cried, "told me you were here, that you are Madame d'Aurillac."
His eyes spoke his admiration. In delight, he beamed upon her.
"I might have known it,"
he murmured. With the confidence of one who is sure he brings good news, he laughed happily.
"And I,"
he cried,
"am Pierrot."
Who the devil Pierrot might be, the spy could not guess. She knew only that she wished by a German shell Pierrot and his car had been blown to tiny fragments. Was it a trap? She asked herself, or was the handsome youth really someone the Countess d'Aurillac should know? But as from his introducing himself it was evident he could not know that lady very well, Marie took courage and smiled.
"Which Pierrot?"
she parried.
"Pierre Thierry,"
cried the youth. To the relief of Marie he turned upon the adjutant and to him explained who Pierre Thierry might be.
"Paul d'Aurillac," he said, "is my dearest friend. When he married this charming lady, I was stationed in Algiers, and but for the war I might never have met her."
To Marie, with his hand on his heart in a most charming manner, he bowed. His admiration he made no effort to conceal.
"And so," he said, "I know why there is war."
The adjutant smiled indulgently and departed on his duties, leaving them alone. The handsome eyes of Captain Thierry were raised to the violet eyes of Marie. They appraised her boldly, and as boldly expressed their approval. In burlesque, the young man exclaimed indignantly,
"Paul deceived me," he cried. "He told me he had married the most beautiful woman in Lon. He has married the most beautiful woman in France."
To Marie, this was not impertinence, but gallantry. This was a language she understood, and this was the type of man, because he was the least difficult to manage, she held most in contempt.
"But about you, Paul did not deceive me,"
she retorted. In apparent confusion, her eyes refused to meet his.
"He told me Pierrot was a most dangerous man."
She continued hurriedly. With wifely solicitude, she asked concerning Paul. She explained that for a week she had been a prisoner in the chateau, and since the mobilization of her husband, save that he was with his regiment in Paris, she had heard nothing. Captain Tilly was able to give her later news. Only the day previous, on the boulevards, he had met Count d'Aulillac. He was at the Grand Hotel, and as Tilly was at once motoring back to Paris, he would give Paul news of their meeting. He hoped he might tell him that soon his wife would also be in Paris. Marie explained that only the illness of her aunt prevented her from that same day joining her husband. Her manner became serious.
"And what other news have you?"
she asked.
"Here on the firing line we know less of what is going forward than you in Paris."
So Pierre Tilly told her all he knew. They were preparing dispatches he was at once to carry back to the general staff, and for the moment, his time was his own. How could he better employ it than in talking of the war with a patriotic and charming French woman? In consequence, Marie acquired a mass of facts, gossip, and guesses. From these, she mentally selected such information as, to her employers across the Aisne, would be of vital interest. And to rid herself of Thierry and on the fourth floor seek Anne Fossey was now her only wish. But in attempting this, by the return of the adjutant she was delayed. To Tilly, the adjutant gave a sealed envelope.
31 Boulevard des Invalides,
he said. With a smile, he turned to Marie.
And you will accompany him.
I!
Exclaimed Marie. She was sick with sudden terror. But the tolerant smile of the adjutant reassured her.
The Count, your husband, he explained, has learned of your detention here by the enemy, and he has besieged the general staff to have you convoyed safely to Paris.
The adjutant glanced at a field telegram he held open in his hand.
He asks, he continued, that you be permitted to return in the car of his friend, Captain Tilly, and that on arriving you join him at the Grand Hotel.
Tilly exclaimed with delight.
But how charming! He cried. Tonight you must dine with me at La Rue's.
He saluted his superior officer.
Some petrol, sir? He said. And I am ready.
To Marie he added,
the car will be at the steps in 5 minutes.
He turned and left them. The thoughts of Marie snatching at an excuse for delay raced madly. The danger of meeting the Count d'Aulillac, her supposed husband, did not alarm her. The Grand Hotel has many exits, and even before they reached it, for leaving the car, she could invent an excuse that the gallant Tilly would not suspect. But what now concerned her was how, before she was whisked away to Paris, she could convey to Anne Fossey the information she had gathered from Tilly. First, of a woman overcome with delight at being reunited with her husband, she gave an excellent imitation. Then she exclaimed in distress,
"But my aunt... Madame Benet,"
she cried,
"I cannot leave her."
"The sisters of Saint Francis," said the adjutant, "arrive within an hour to nurse the wounded. They will care also for your aunt."
Marie concealed her chagrin.
"Then I will at once prepare to go,"
she said. The adjutant handed her a slip of paper.
"You laissez passer to Paris," he said. "You leave in 5 minutes, madame."
As temporary hostess of the chateau, Marie was free to visit any part of it, and as she passed her door, a signal from Madame Benet told her that Anfossi was on the fourth floor, that he was at work, and that the coast was clear. Softly, in the felt slippers she always wore, as she explained, in order not to disturb the wounded, she mounted the staircase. In her hand she carried the housekeeper's keys, and as an excuse it was her plan to return with an armful of linen for the arriving sisters. But Marie never reached the top of the stairs. When her eyes rose to the level of the fourth floor, she came to a sudden halt. At what she saw, terror gripped her, bound her hand and foot, and turned her blood to ice. At her post, for an instant, Madame Benet had slept, and an officer of the staff, led by curiosity, chance, or suspicion, had, unobserved and unannounced, mounted to the fourth floor. When Marie saw him, he was in front of the room that held the wireless. His back was toward her, but she saw that he was holding the door to the room ajar, that his eye was pressed to the opening, and that through it he had pushed the muzzle of his automatic. What would be the fate of Anfossi, Marie knew. Nor did she for an instant consider it. Her thoughts were of her own safety, that she might live. Not that she might still serve the Wilhelmstrasse, the Kaiser, or the Fatherland, but that she might live. In a moment Anfossi would be denounced. The chateau would ring with the alarm, and, though she knew Anfossi would not betray her, by others she might be accused. To avert suspicion from herself, she saw only one way open. She must be the first to denounce Anfossi. Like a deer, she leaped down the marble stairs and, in a panic she had no need to assume, burst into the presence of the staff.
"Gentlemen," she gasped, "my servant, the chauffeur Briand, is a spy. There is a German wireless in the chateau. He is using it. I have seen him."
With exclamations, the officers rose to their feet. General André alone remained seated. General André was a veteran of many colonial wars. Cochin China, Algiers, Morocco. The Great War, when it came, found him on duty in the intelligence department. His aquiline nose, bristling white eyebrows, and flashing restless eyes gave him his nickname of L'Aigle. In amazement, the flashing eyes were now turned upon Marie. He glared at her as though he thought she suddenly had flown mad.
"A German wireless?" he protested. "It is impossible."
"I was on the fourth floor,"
panted Marie,
"collecting linen for the sisters. In the room next to the linen closet, I heard a strange buzzing sound. I opened the door softly. I saw Briand, with his back to me, seated by an instrument. There were receivers clamped to his ears. My God, the disgrace! The disgrace to my husband and to me, who vouched for him to you!"
Apparently in an agony of remorse, the fingers of the woman laced and interlaced.
"I cannot forgive myself."
The officers moved toward the door, but General André halted them. Still in a tone of incredulity, he demanded,
"When did you see this?"
Marie knew the question was coming, knew she must explain how she saw Briand, and yet did not see the staff officer who, with his prisoner, might now at any instant appear. She must make it plain she had discovered the spy and left the upper part of the house before the officer had visited it. When that was, she could not know, but the chance was that he had preceded her by only a few minutes.
"When did you see this?"
repeated the general.
"But just now," cried Marie, "not 10 minutes since."
"Why did you not come to me at once?"
"I was afraid,"
replied Marie.
"If I moved, I was afraid he might hear me, and he, knowing I would expose him, would kill me, and so escape you."
There was an eager whisper of approval. For silence, General André slapped his hand upon the table.
"Then,"
continued Marie,
"I understood with the receivers on his ears, he could not have heard me open the door, nor could he hear me leave, and I ran to my aunt. The thought that we had harbored such an animal sickened me, and I was weak enough to feel faint. But only for an instant. Then I came here."
She moved swiftly to the door.
"Let me show you the room,"
she begged.
"You can take him in the act.
her eyes wild with the excitement of the chase, swept the circle.
"Will you come?"
she begged. Unconscious of the crisis he interrupted, the orderly on duty opened the door.
"Captain Tilly's compliments,"
he recited mechanically.
"And is he to delay longer for Madame de Aurillac?"
With a sharp gesture, General André waved Marie toward the door. Without rising, he inclined his head.
"Adieu, madame," he said. "We act at once upon your information. I thank you."
As she crossed from the hall to the terrace, the ears of the spy were assaulted by a sudden tumult of voices. They were raised in threats and curses. Looking back, she saw Anfossi descending the stairs. His hands were held above his head. Behind him, with his automatic, the staff officer she had surprised on the fourth floor was driving him forward. Above the clenched fists of the soldiers that ran to meet him, the eyes of Anfossi were turned toward her. His face was expressionless, his eyes neither accused nor reproached, and with the joy of one who has looked upon and then escaped the guillotine, Marie ran down the steps to the waiting automobile. With a pretty cry of pleasure, she leaped into the seat beside Tilly. Gaily, she threw out her arms.
"To Paris,"
she commanded. The handsome eyes of Tilly, eloquent with admiration, looked back into hers. He stooped, threw in the clutch, and the great gray car with the machine gun and its crew of privates guarding the rear plunged through the park. "To Paris," echoed Tilly. In the order in which Marie had last seen them, Anfossi and the staff officer entered the room of General André, and upon the soldiers in the hall the door was shut. The face of the staff officer was grave, but his voice could not conceal his elation.
"My general," he reported, "I found this man in the act of giving information to the enemy. There is wireless."
General André rose slowly. He looked neither at the officer nor at his prisoner. With frowning eyes, he stared down at the maps upon his table.
"I know," he interrupted. "Someone has already told me."
He paused, and then, as though recalling his manners, but still without raising his eyes, he added,
"You have done well, sir."
In silence, the officers of the staff stood motionless. With surprise, they noted that, as yet, neither in anger nor curiosity had General André glanced at the prisoner. But of the presence of the general, the spy was most acutely conscious. He stood erect, his arms still raised, but his body strained forward, and on the averted eyes of the general his own were fixed. In an agony of supplication, they asked a question. At last, as though against his wish, toward the spy the general turned his head, and their eyes met. And still General André was silent. Then the arms of the spy, like those of a runner who has finished his race and breasts the tape exhausted, fell to his sides. In a voice low and vibrant, he spoke his question.
"It has been so long, sir," he pleaded. "May I not come home?"
General André turned to the astonished group surrounding him. His voice was hushed, like that of one who speaks across an open grave.
"Gentlemen," he began, "my children," he added. "A German spy, a woman, involved in a scandal, your brother-in-arms, Henri Ravignac. His honor, he thought, was concerned, and without honor he refused to live. To prove him guiltless, his younger brother Charles asked leave to seek out the woman who had betrayed Henri, and by us was detailed on secret service. He gave up home, family, friends. He lived in exile, in poverty, at all times in danger of a swift and ignoble death. In the War Office, we know him as one who has given to his country services she cannot hope to reward, for she cannot return to him the years he has lost. She cannot return to him his brother. But she can and will clear the name of Henri Ravignac, and upon his brother Charles bestow promotion and honors."
The general turned and embraced the spy.
"My children," he said, "welcome your brother. He has come home."
Before the car had reached the fortifications, Marie Gessler had arranged her plan of escape. She had departed from the chateau without even a handbag, and she would say that before the shops closed, she must make purchases. Le Printemps lay in their way, and she asked that when they reached it, for a moment she might alight. Captain Tilly readily gave permission. From the department store it would be most easy to disappear, and in anticipation Marie smiled covertly. Nor was the picture of Captain Tilly impatiently waiting outside unamusing. But before Le Printemps was approached, the car turned sharply down a narrow street. On one side, along its entire length, ran a high gray wall, grim and forbidding. In it was a green gate studded with iron bolts. Before this, the automobile drew suddenly to a halt. The crew of the armored car tumbled off the rear seat, and one of them beat upon the green gate. Marie felt a hand of ice clutch at her throat, but she controlled herself.
"And what is this?"
she cried gaily. At her side, Captain Tilly was smiling down at her, but his smile was hateful.
"It is the prison of Saint-Lazare," he said. "It is not becoming," he added sternly, "that the name of the Countess d'Aurillac should be made common as the Paris road."
Fighting for her life, Marie thrust herself against him. Her arm, that throughout the journey had rested on the back of the driving seat, caressed his shoulders. Her lips and the violet eyes were close to his.
"Why should you care?"
she whispered fiercely.
"You have me. Let the Count d'Aurillac look after the honor of his wife himself."
The charming Tilly laughed at her mockingly.
"He means to," he said.
"I am the Count d'Aurillac."